It's the early 2000s, and Palm Beach businessman Fred Keller has amassed an enormous fortune in real estate.
It was probably worth around $100 million.
Keller was in the midst of a bitter divorce from his wife, Rose, who was awarded half of his money and assets.
He wasn't happy about it, and he wanted it appealed.
But before the appeal could ever be heard in court, his ex-wife is killed, her brother is shot, and Keller is charged with murder.
Because there was a struggle, and the gun goes off and shoots the wife, and kills her almost instantly.
Hi, I'm Joey Dowd.
And I'm Kareem Tapsch.
Beaches, nightlife, and tropical weather may be what folks think of when they think Florida. But as Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
Each week, we'll bring you a new episode of a true crime case committed right here under the Florida sun. From the outrageous to the utterly bizarre. Think you've heard it all? Think again. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami. In the early 1980s, Fred Keller moves from Washington, D.C. to Palm Beach. A descendant of German immigrants, he methodically built up a real estate empire.
He was definitely a self-made man.
That's Bennett Cohn, one of Fred's attorneys and a longtime friend.
He had worked for people that up north, and he learned from them how they made their money. And he felt that if he could do what they did, he could make money as well. And so that's what he did. He started to buy real estate.
Now, these weren't lavish real estate projects like hotels or golf courses. They were basic but profitable industrial buildings like warehouses, strip malls, and commercial buildings.
He'd buy one building after another, strategically looking for undiscovered bargains. Eventually, he owned more than 60 buildings and was worth millions.
And that's how he started, and he continued, needless to say, not with luck, but with a lot of hard work. That hard work made him a difficult individual.
He was also known for being strict, shrewd, and always ready to take a dispute to court.
Fred was a real estate mogul who became very, very wealthy. I first met him probably in the early to mid-90s, and I had a case against him, and I won. And Fred always thought that he had the best lawyers in town, and he couldn't believe that I, as a younger lawyer, beat his, what he thought was his superior, more well-known lawyer. And after the case was over, about 2 days later, I get a call from him, which, needless to say, I was surprised. And I said, "What can I do for you, Mr. Keller?" And he said, "Anybody that's good enough to beat my lawyers, I want to be my lawyer." And that's how our relationship from an attorney-client standpoint started. And then I was his lawyer for the next 20 years.
It was important for Fred to have the best lawyers around because he was known to always be involved in some type of lawsuit.
According to NBC, people that knew Fred described him as ruthless.
Fred and his company, Keller Trust, was the plaintiff in nearly 200 civil and small claims cases. He sued tenants for non-payment and eviction. He even sued ex-girlfriends and family members.
One attorney said he'd go to court over a dollar. According to the Palm Beach Post, it was a matter of principle. He was going to win at all costs.
Fred was a bit of a paradox. He enjoyed making money, but didn't live the life of luxury.
Despite his wealth, the wealth, quite frankly, was meaningless to him. I mean, this isn't a guy that walked around in Armani suits. It wasn't important to him.
He wore dated clothes and drove an old Cadillac. He enjoyed tennis, but according to NBC News, was too cheap to join one of the South Florida country clubs, so he played at the public courts for $200 a year.
If I said to you, "Would you like $100 million? You'd say, "Hell yeah, I'd like $100 million. But it wasn't important to him. in terms of his lifestyle. Did he enjoy doing things? Yes. Did he care if he didn't do them? No. He wasn't into that. That doesn't mean that he didn't enjoy working, because he enjoyed the making of the money.
His mansion was run down, like there were holes in the ceiling.
He kept a strict schedule, woke up at the same time every day, worked out, ate a tuna fish sandwich for lunch, would go to work, and then had dinner at 6 on the dot. According to his former sister-in-law, if he said dinner was at 6, it didn't mean 5:55 or 6:03, it meant 6. She said it could be like walking on eggshells.
It was his way or the highway.
He could be a difficult individual. There is no question about that.
Now, Fred had children with his first wife before getting divorced, but we'll get to that later. After his first marriage, he tied the knot 3 more times. All ended in divorce.
After 4 failed marriages, he decided American women weren't his thing. They were too liberated for his more traditional sensibilities. He wanted someone with the same ethnic background as him. This is 1992, before internet dating existed.
So he did the analog equivalent, put an ad for a wife in the classifieds of the newspaper. The ad wasn't subtle. He was explicit about what he was looking for and what he could offer. Quote, millionaire seeks 25 to 39-year-old, slim, attractive, playmate to share a lifestyle of the rich and famous, end quote, according to a story from the Palm Beach Post.
A woman in the small German town of Dorlar saw the ad and immediately thought of her 25-year-old daughter, Rose.
He met Rose through an article in a German magazine. She was an attractive woman, 34 years younger than him. And their relationship, you know, blossomed like literally overnight. And when she gets to the United States, she literally gets here with a bag the size of a backpack, you know, and maybe $20. She literally came to this country with nothing.
Fred eventually proposed to Rose, and she accepted. Before getting married, Fred had Rose sign a prenup.
In the agreement, Rose waived any right to the property Fred owned before they would get married. It also said that in the event of a divorce, Rose's claims could not be more than 10% of Fred's assets.
Rose agreed to the terms, and they got married in August of 1992, just 5 months after first meeting Fred.
3 of Rose's siblings, Wolfgang, Klaus, and Angelica, moved to South Florida, sometimes living in the guest house on the property. Fred helped put her brothers through college and gave Wolfgang a job.
Rose had many hobbies, including photography, painting, and playing the piano. Fred supported all of these interests, buying her cameras, easels, and a piano.
Now, Fred had a vasectomy, but he wanted to have a child with Rose, so he had the vasectomy surgically reversed. In 1995, their son was born. They named him Fredchen, German for Freddy.
To celebrate the occasion, he bought a $1.5 million beachfront mansion in Palm Beach. Rose's English also improved, going from passable to fluent. According to NBC News, Fred started teaching her about his real estate empire. John Herring, Fred's business associate, said Rose was starting to look like his protege.
She even received a six-figure salary from his company. But things aren't always what they seem.
And after 8 years of happy marriage, things turned bad. Rose's sister described Fred as being physically and emotionally abusive to everyone, but especially to Rose.
He also had other plans for succession, and Rose was not included.
Fred was born in 1934 in New York to German immigrant parents as Fred Bullender. When Fred was 2, his family briefly moved back to Germany, where his father served in Hitler's SS. But according to the St. Petersburg Times, he defected and the family moved back to the US after the war.
Fred grew up fairly poor. His father earned a meager living as a cabinet maker. Later in life, he acknowledged his obsession with possessions and wanting to be more than working class. According to the website Crime Library, his writings hinted at a superiority complex. He wrote about a girl he was attracted to growing up, but dismissed her as a potential partner because she was genetically inferior to his standards.
Just some of our own speculation here. His father may have defected from Hitler's SS, but some of the Nazis' genetic propaganda seems to have seeped into his son, Fred. After serving in the U.S. Army in Korea, Fred attended college for a year, then found himself working as an engineer in Virginia. In 1956, he married his first wife, Blanche. Blanche already had a young son named Brian, whom Fred adopted. According to the Tampa Bay Times, Fred said she was, quote, good breeding stock for a future family, end quote. Together, they had two sons, Eric and Paul.
Now, this relationship didn't last long, but instead of amicably splitting, it took a bizarre turn. Basically, Fred kidnapped the kids, and not just his own biological kids, Eric and Paul, but also Blanche's son that he adopted, Brian. He drove them up to Canada, then took a plane to Germany where they traveled throughout Europe for a year. He told the boys their mom had died in a car crash.
He had two sons by his wife, and he kidnapped the two sons and moved from that area, telling the sons that the mother was deceased, that she didn't love him, and that he was going to take care of them.
Fred ended up moving back to the U.S. to Washington, D.C. This is when he changed his name to Keller to make him harder to find. But Blanche would eventually track Fred down and her children 9 years later.
But at this point, Fred had money. He negotiated a $10,000 settlement with Blanche, and she agreed to not press criminal charges. This was a time when family abductions were seen as domestic disputes, and authorities usually didn't get involved. Even more shocking, he was still granted custody of the children he kidnapped and said their mom had died. Blanche would later say Fred had beat her. His children also said he was abusive and tried to manipulate them against their mother.
And I had heard about it, but it's nothing that we would, you know, talk about.
Bennett Cohen again, Fred's attorney and friend. Bennett met Fred later in life, so he didn't know about his past until it came out in court documents.
And then I heard about the treatment of the sons and some of the things that supposedly he had done. And maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I'm going to assume that they occurred. But they weren't anything that we spent any time in discussing.
When you heard about them, did it line up with the Fred that you knew? Or did it seem like that doesn't seem like the Fred that I know? Like, how did that reconcile with you?
Well, actually, I was both surprised and unsurprised.
This is when Fred went through his other short-lived marriages. One woman he was with, Lynn Weatherby, was 20 years younger than Fred. At this point, he already had his vasectomy and his sons were adults. So he tried to convince Lynn to get artificially inseminated by one of his sons.
She declined and the couple broke up, but not before Fred sued Weatherby for the $2,225 he said he loaned her. Remember, this guy's worth millions. And this is the point at which Fred decides he needs a woman that shares his background. And he puts out a classified ad in the newspapers for a wife, which leads him to marrying Rose.
Rose has gone from passable English to fluent English. She's getting more involved in Fred's real estate empire, and it's questioned if she might be the successor to take it over. Also in the mix is Wolfgang, Rose's brother who came over from Germany and was supported by Rose and Fred. He also got involved in the business, and some believed, according to NBC, that he was being groomed to take over.
But according to Bennett, none of this was true.
Now, I saw in some articles or that there was that she was getting more involved in the business, she was taking a salary, she was possibly being groomed to take it over. Was there any accuracy in that?
Zero. She always thought that at some point she and her brother would take over if something were ever to happen to Fred. But the fact of the matter is that the person who was ultimately supposed to, if something happens to Fred, the person who was supposed to take over as manager of the business was not the family. It was me.
Rose was also interested in the Palm Beach social scene and wanted to go out more and belong to country clubs. Fred saw Rose turning into a social climber.
She always wanted him to, you know, join different clubs, do different things, take her to places where she could be shown off. she always thought that because of the money that he had, that she ought to be the princess, if not the queen, of Palm Beach. And that wasn't his cup of tea.
This, on top of Rose's family getting involved in the business, is when the marriage started to deteriorate and Fred's control became obsessive.
According to Rose's sister, Fred told Rose when to breastfeed and when to stop breastfeeding. He told her not to go into Fredson's room when he was crying and to just let him cry. He decided when they could watch TV, and he decided what they could watch. He refused to allow Rose to see a doctor for a broken toe because he was afraid of the medical bills. And to reiterate, once again, this man is a millionaire.
Now, with Rose's better understanding of finance and the business, she wasn't happy with the terms of the original prenup. At the time they got married, Fred was worth about $17 million. Now he was worth nearly $100 million, thanks to real estate prices jumping up in South Florida.
Rose felt her involvement in the business helped contribute to this and wanted it reflected in the prenup. So she asked for it to be updated from the original 10% she was guaranteed to 50%. Fred was not happy about this.
Fred tried to convince her he updated it by scribbling down a handwritten promise and signing some documents that there'd be a 50-50 split, which he knew was not legally binding. According to Crime Library, Rose thought she was being treated as a second-class partner in the relationship.
The end came when Fred had a heart attack in 1999. He was upset that Rose continued to ask him to change the prenup while he was recovering. In an argument, Fred told Rose that her days were numbered. Rose took that as a threat and fled the house with Fredson. Fred said he was just referring to the marriage.
She tried to get a restraining order against Fred, citing the threats to her life, but this was denied, with the judge saying Rose had failed to provide evidence of abuse. In 2000, Rose filed for divorce.
At the time of the divorce, she tries to avoid the prenup by saying that she didn't understand English. And so she didn't know what she was signing. The only problem is that Fred wasn't a complete idiot. Fred had a German interpreter there. And so everything that was in the prenup was fully and completely translated to her.
Rose claimed she was more than just a wife. She was a business partner and her skill helped increase Fred's fortune. Fred underestimated his wealth. He said he only had $60 million. In reality, his net worth was estimated at $70 to $100 million. He offered Rose $5.7 million, or 10% as laid out in the prenup.
Rose wanted half of Fred's assets, plus attorney's fees. They went to court where a judge looked over every aspect of their marriage. The story about Fred agreeing to a 50-50 split was brought up, which Fred thought wouldn't be legally binding.
Finally, after 3 years, the judge issues her ruling. And she ruled in Rose's favor. The judge ordered Fred to give her half of his assets. That would be 24 land trusts, the Palm Beach mansion, and their summer home, a Virginia horse farm. All the assets totaled nearly $50 million.
He also had to pay her legal fees at about $8,600 a month in child support, and she got custody of Fredson.
Fred had romantically moved on. He was living in a million-dollar condo he had bought, and his new girlfriend was a young Russian woman.
On November 10th, 11 days after the judge's decision, Rose and Fred agreed to meet at his office to discuss some of the details of divvying up the assets. Rose brought along her brother, Wolfgang. Shortly after the meeting begins, though, Wolfgang ends up shot, and Rose is dead. Fred is left holding the gun. But was it a murder, or was it self-defense?
About a week after the divorce is finalized, Fred, Rose, and her brother Wolfgang meet at Fred's office to discuss the divorce settlement. But just 10 minutes after the meeting begins, Fred's assistant hears gunshots.
Another employee, Michael Eaton, sees Fred walk out of the office. He asks where Rose was, and Fred points towards the room. When Michael enters, he finds Wolfgang on the floor calling 911. Wolfgang says Fred Keller just shot him and his sister, but he was able to get the weapon from him.
Wolfgang is shot twice, once in the chest and once in the back. Fred is shot once in the struggle. A bullet grazed his cheek.
And Rose is dead. A bullet struck her neck, severing her spinal cord. In the end, there was only one gun in that room, and that gun belonged to Fred Keller. But Was this cold-blooded murder or self-defense?
According to Wolfgang's story, the meeting had started when Fred suddenly pulled out his pistol, pointed it across the table, and shot him in the chest. He then turned the gun to Rose and shot her in the neck.
The brother-in-law's theory of the case was he pulls out the gun and shoots the brother-in-law, and they start to struggle with the gun, and the gun ultimately goes off because there was a struggle.
Wolfgang rushed around the table and tackled Fred. In this struggle is when Wolfgang was shot a second time in the back and Fred was grazed on his cheek.
Fred's story, he saw Wolfgang reach for a large black object and thought he was about to shoot him, so he acted in self-defense. But turns out Wolfgang didn't have a gun. It was his cell phone.
And let me just preference this for you, because what I'm going to tell you sounds ridiculous. And if you remember in the old days, that the cell phones, they weren't iPhones. They had little antennas on them. What happened was, is that the brother pulls out of his pocket the cell phone, to which Fred, who did carry a gun and was licensed to carry a gun, sees this coming out of the pocket onto the table. He opens up, just kind of like flips open his little bag and fires the gun because he thinks that he is going to be shot.
In Fred's version, he shoots Wolfgang in self-defense, Wolfgang tackles him, and in the struggle, the gun goes off and accidentally kills Rose.
And so when I got this call, you know, that there had been a shooting in the morning, it was about maybe 8:30 or so a.m., and that I thought that Fred had been shot. But and so I went to the hospital. He was asking for me. I went to the hospital and you know, heard what was going on. And you know, did he want me to do anything for him? And he says, no, that he had already, you know, hired a, you know, local criminal lawyer, but he wanted me to work with them and give them any information and all information that might be helpful during the case.
Fred carrying a gun was something new. Rose did not know he was armed.
According to NBC News, Fred started carrying a gun fairly recently for his protection, from Rose. The week before the shooting, he had reported to the police that Rose threatened to shoot his employees and he feared for their safety.
Bill Frazier, an investigator for the prosecutor's office, thought Fred's claim was a setup so that he could have a self-defense excuse. At the end of the day, only one person in that room had a gun, and it looked like a cold-blooded murder.
The police believed Wolfgang's versions of events and charged Fred with first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, and shooting into a building. He's 70 years old.
Now, we already know Fred claims he mistook Wolfgang's cell phone as a gun and was acting in self-defense. But there are a few other elements that cast doubt for Bennett that Fred was trying to kill his wife. For one, according to Bennett, Wolfgang was about to be deported back to Germany.
It made no sense. If the brother-in-law was going to be deported, why would you pull a gun and shoot him? That kind of aspect made no sense to me.
Right, so you're saying Fred knew the brother-in-law was going to be deported in a few days?
Yes. And he knows it because I'm the one that told him.
Bennett also believed this was uncharacteristic for Fred.
I mean, the murder was kind of peculiar because Fred's way of getting even with people wasn't to pull out a gun and shoot them. His way of getting even with people was to sue them.
And Fred was doing just that. The morning of the shooting, he already filed an appeal to the divorce settlement. Bennett wasn't on Fred's legal defense team. One of his defense lawyers, Doug Duncan, argued, why would a man as calculating as Fred commit a poorly planned murder with no exit strategy that he'd surely be blamed for?
He also argued that Fred knew he had a terminal illness and wouldn't want to leave his son, Fretchen, orphaned.
Fred said himself, quote, I've been called a lot of things in my life, but no one's ever called me stupid. For me to kill someone, for me to kill Rose, lose my money, I would gain nothing by her death. Lose my freedom. Lose my son. That is stupid. End quote.
Dan Gallo, one of the prosecutors, argued Fred was bitter and wanted revenge on his wife and brother-in-law, rather than split his fortune.
He said, quote, this is not a man who likes to lose, but he lost. He lost big. End quote. end quote. The jury took 5 days to deliberate, one of the longest in Palm Beach history.
Ultimately, they couldn't come to a unanimous decision. The jury was nearly split 50-50. The judge declared a mistrial.
Worried that Fred would get out on bond as he waited for the retrial, there was a bond hearing. In the original trial, nothing about Fred's past, including kidnapping his children, was allowed to be presented. But in the bond hearing, it was.
Brian Bolander took the stand, Fred's adopted son from his first wife, who he kidnapped. Brian had cut off all contact with Fred.
He said Fred physically and mentally abused him as a child. He did some barbaric things like make him or one of his brothers drink their own vomit or eat out of a dog food bowl as punishment. He also basically waterboarded them, holding their head underwater until they were convinced they would drown. Brian said, quote, "I would characterize him as sick and evil and mean-spirited," end quote.
Keller was viewed as a definite flight risk and denied bail. He waited for his retrial at the Palm Beach County Jail.
The Palm Beach County Jail was not too far from my office, and he would call me all the time and say, "What are you doing tonight?" And I'd say, "I'm working." And he'd say, "Well, could you leave early and come over? I'd like to talk to you." And I would go to the jail and visit him. I knew all the guards. And we would talk, but not necessarily about business. He just wanted somebody to talk to. And the only person that he trusted to talk to about most everything was me. And so that's, while he was in jail for those several years, I probably saw him, not every day, but I certainly saw him at least 3 or 4 times a week.
Fred's leukemia returned and he underwent treatment, which postponed the trial. Eventually, the retrial happened, and once again, a jury had to decide if Fred genuinely mistook a cell phone as a gun and acted in self-defense, or if he killed his wife in cold blood.
Do I know if he really thought that the gun was a phone that was across the table? I haven't the vaguest idea. All I know is that the first jury believed it. The second jury didn't believe it.
The second jury only took 5 hours to come back with a verdict. In May 2007, Fred was convicted of first-degree murder and attempted murder. Fred was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms in prison.
It wouldn't take long to serve out the life sentence. Just a few months later, in August, Fred died from anemia related to the leukemia he had been dealing with. He was 73. Before he died, he was taken to Larkin Community Hospital. He wanted to see his son, Fredgen, one last time, and Bennett tried to get his son to the hospital, but he died before he was able to see him.
His death, which very few people know about, was very, very unusual. When he was in prison, he had been told by one of his other lawyers that the law in Florida was that if while your case was on appeal, you died, that wiped out the conviction. If you wiped out the conviction, then all of the things that he wanted to see that would happen for his son in his will couldn't take place because he wouldn't have inherited anything because of the death of his wife. And if you kill someone, you can't keep the funds. And so what happened was he was told that if he died, that the son would be able to get everything that was given to him in the will. That he had leukemia. And he had it for a number of years. And so what happened is he decides that he's not going to take the medication anymore. And if he doesn't take the medication, he had been told by his doctors in Texas that he could die in a relatively short order. And so that's what he did. He stopped taking the medication and he died. Except the lawyer who gave him that information gave him the wrong information. And everything that he had went by another version of the will and not what he was told by one of the lawyers. I thought that was kind of an unusual kind of thing, but that's what he wanted to do for his son.
Thank you.
After Fred's death, there were wrongful death lawsuits and injury lawsuits filed against the estate. Fredchen was awarded $30 million, but hasn't seen any of it since most of the estate's money has been going to attorney's fees.
He always used to talk about if anything ever happened to him, if anything, you know, went on, that he wanted me to make sure that his son was well taken care of and that no one took advantage of his wealth through his son. And after his death, there was litigation between his manager and him. The lawyers made millions of dollars off of the guardianship and the probate action. How much was left at the end from $100 million? I would be shocked if it was more than 25%.
According to one lawyer, Fredchen, quote, hasn't received a dime, but lawyers have received millions and millions of dollars. There is something wrong with that, in my opinion, end quote.
Listen, it's unfortunate. If Fred did it, then I guess you could say that the verdict was a just one and that he deserves whatever penalty the judge assessed to him. If he didn't do it, it's not going to much matter because he's dead anyway.
Which version are you inclined to believe?
Well, I'm inclined to believe that Fred Keller was not a saint, but I'm also inclined to believe that he didn't show up to kill anybody, because the purpose of it, of that meeting, was to start talking about dividing what the court had ordered. And he wasn't that stupid, in my opinion, to go there with a gun to start shooting somebody when there are people in the office. It just makes no sense to me. I feel sorry for the son because at that incident, he lost both of his parents.
While Fredchen did lose both of his parents, the fortune his father built and hoped to pass on to him wasn't completely dissolved through fees and settlements. In 2016, the last of Keller's commercial properties were sold for $50 million.
Thank you for listening to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, where each new episode will bring you a true crime story right from the South Florida headlines.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a production of Sonoro and Trojan Horse in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Network. Hosted and produced by Kareem Tapsch, Joey Dowd, and Christian Hatar. Edited by Angelina Mosher Salazar. Fact-checking by Evelyn Uribe and Sara Mota. Engineering by Mane Parra, Daniel Padilla, and Fernando Galaviz. Executive produced by Jasmine Romero and Joshua Weinstein for Sonoro, Kareem Tapsch and Alex Fumero for Trojan Horse, and Giselle Bansis and Conal Byrne for iHeart. Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.